On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us,
the Murray Family, at mauramurrayfamilydirect@gmail.com,
or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray.
Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. How's it going, Lance?
It's going pretty well. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing all right today, Lance. And for this interview today, Lance, we spoke to two young journalists from French Canada, Quebec, actually, Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada, and they've covered the case of Louise Chaput, who is from Sherbrooke, Quebec, and was murdered in the White Mountains.
Yeah, it was very interesting to talk to these two gentlemen, Boris and Julian. They've been following the case for a while, and one of the more interesting things that they brought up was their relationship and their interaction with law enforcement. And I don't know why I thought that it would be different, but it was interesting to hear how similar it is to all the other stories, on top of the fact that they were communicating through the American-Canadian border, too.
Right. A lot of obstacles in investigating this case, you can kind of tell, because there's obviously a border, a jurisdiction issue with Louise having come from Sherbrooke on her trip. And she went hiking alone in the White Mountains where she was murdered seemingly by someone random.
Yes, she was last seen on November 15th, 2001, and her body was found on November 22nd, 2001. So just a few days later, she had left, and it was late in the season for hiking. She left to go do this on her own, and that was another interesting thing that we found out from these two gentlemen, is that she was very much into doing things like this. She liked to hike on her own. She liked to be a woman of her own means. She really liked the independent nature of things, and hiking was no different. She would go alone all the time. And she was found on November 22nd. She had multiple stab wounds. Her death was definitely ruled a homicide. And she was burned, too, which is quite telling.
Yeah, really sad, tragic. They also talk about Chuck West from the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit a little bit in this episode, having had that experience. And they say some interesting things, things that I hadn't known about Chuck West. Like, actually, they called him a national hero. And he was written about in this book because he solved this murder, or at least helped to solve this murder, of these Dartmouth College professors, as documented in this book here, Judgment Ridge, the true story behind the Dartmouth murders. So I can't wait to dig into this one.
That's correct. Chuck West was instrumental in solving the murders of the college professors, the Dartmouth College professors, Half and Suzanne Zantop. They were 62 and 55, respectively, and they were stabbed to death in their home in Etna, New Hampshire. And the two apprehended were James Parker, who was 16, and Robert Tulloch, who was 17. And they were charged with first-degree murder.
And Lance, this goes out to a lot of people in New Hampshire, and so we want to make sure that you are all on the lookout for a blue backpack with a Canadian flag that was missing from Louise Chaput's murder scene. Also, Ford Focus keys. So it is possible someone in the hiking community knows more. So if you are in the hiking community, especially, or if you know people in the hiking community, maybe ask around. I know it was a long time ago, but maybe someone still remembers something.
And you can also submit a tip through the Department of Justice, the New Hampshire branch. If you go to doj.nh.gov and search for Louise Chaput, that's Louise Chaput, gives a little description of the crime, and you can use their tip form to submit a tip.
And Lance, we're going live on Get Vocal Thursday night. If you're listening to this on release day, that would be tonight with Patrick Hines of True Crime Obsessed. Join us 9 p.m. Eastern on getvocal.com. Check it out. Link in the show notes.
That's going to be a fun show because we've been planning this live show with True Crime Obsessed, Patrick and Jillian and Maggie and you and myself. We've been planning this. We did the show in Brooklyn and then it went so well. They were like, we should do a couple more. We had one planned for Boston and one planned for Philadelphia. Obviously, we weren't able to do those at the end of March and then they rescheduled them for August. And once again, those have been rescheduled. Date is TBD, but in the meantime, yeah, Patrick Hines is being gracious enough to join us tomorrow night at 9 p.m. That should be a really fun time.
And Lance, on this date, June 11th, 1996, Tina Lynn D'Ambrosio was 34 years old when she went missing from Phoenix, Arizona.
At the time of the disappearance, Tina was 5 foot 7 inches, 123 pounds, with auburn hair and blue eyes. She has a light-colored birthmark on her back and a scar extending from the back of her neck to the top of her head. Tina also wears a full set of dentures and had previously fractured her jaw.
Anyone with information should contact the Phoenix Police Department at 602-261-8042.
And for more information on Tina's disappearance, you can go to namus.gov/missingpersons, and hers is case number 490.
And that, of course, comes from Private Investigations for the Missing. So make sure to follow them on social and check out the site, investigationsforthemissing.org. That is the nonprofit that we are on the board of.
And as a reminder, this is the nonprofit that Bruce Maitland, father of Brianna Maitland, founded. It is to provide assistance to families who still don't know where their loved ones are. They've been missing and they need resources to hire licensed private investigators to assist them in their search.
Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Follow us on social. There are links in the show notes. We are being joined by Julian and Boris. How's it going, fellas?
We're good.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I feel like we've been touching base with you guys for like a year and a half about this case. And it's so good to finally get to talk to you. Virtual face-to-face.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And you gave us some context for making up our podcast, so that was greatly appreciated.
Great. Well, happy to help. Awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and a little bit about your podcast?
Yeah, well, we started Saint Eyes, which is a true crime podcast in French. We're located in Elmer, Quebec, so just across the river from Ottawa, the Canada's capital. It's a French podcast. You can hear it in our accents. we started working on the first case in 2017, 2018, which happened in Hull, Quebec, like a few miles from where we work and live. It was a first case called Valérie Leblanc. And I was studying at a college where when maybe 2 years after I graduated, a girl was killed on the second day of school in August 2011. So it was kind of crazy in Gatineau, Hull-Elmer, and it was a traumatic event for the people here in Quebec, and it was never solved. So the killer is still on the run, and it was a really, really strange event because she was killed at about noon on the second day of school, less than a mile from where we studied. So that's when we started looking into the case, and we produced the first season of Saint Eyes.
It was a hit in Quebec, I must say. The podcast got very famous because it's a very mysterious case, and it launched us into making a second season, which took place in the United States, and thus us contacting you.
So I was producing and hosting the first season with a guy called Steven Boivin, who works at Transistor, our production podcast company. And I met Boris for the second season. Boris and I met at CBC Radio Canada, think. He was a journalist. I was a producer for the Canada's National Radio. And we started working on the case together because
You wanted a journalist, I think, to work on this case.
Exactly.
And since I had a little bit of background into crimes stories, I used to be reporter for Le Journal de Montréal, which is one of the biggest French newspapers from Montreal. And I did some crime journalism in my career. So Julien, I think, was interested in this background.
Yeah, yeah. Boris's input and his professional approach to crime journalism and investigative podcasts. So we jumped into Louise's case because the coroner.
That's a cool story.
Yeah, yeah. The coroner, the coroner,
the medical examiner.
who was working on the Valérie's case was a good friend of my dad because my dad is an investigating doctor coroner here in Quebec. Mm-hmm. I don't think the coroner have the same approach or the same role in US or Canada, but still I was interested in crime reporting because my dad was investigating on some crimes here in Quebec. So we met Marie Pinault, who was a character in the first season, and then Marie told us a story about her best friend who got murdered in the White Mountains in 2001. And she told us that when she was her first case was Valérie Leblanc, that took place 10 years after that in 2011. So when she told us the story that her best friend was found in the woods, severely burned, and after a few days of search, so her best friend was Louise Chaput, and she thought when her first homicide with Valérie Leblanc, the first reaction was, oh my God, is this the same murderer who took Valérie's life and Louise, because the both cases look alike. So that's why we got interested in Louise's case, because since Marie was her best friend, and Louise is the reason why Marie got into this kind of work. She was a nurse, and she decided to get her degree, her medical degree, and then she became a coroner for this exact reason. So
after her friend got murdered, so
that's why we got interested in Louise's case, to keep on looking into this this story.
Now, Louise, well, she left her home in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and she went to Pinkham's Grant on November 15, 2001. And I got to back up a little bit. She was the best friend of someone who you were working with on that first case. Did you say the name was Valérie?
Valérie was the teen that got murdered in 2011.
And the medical examiner of that case was the best friend of Louise Chaput, oddly enough.
And
she became medical examiner. She became doctor at the first place after her best friend Louise Chaput got murdered. And she, since day one, she was documenting Louise Chaput's case. And that is the very thing that got us interested, because she had every single document from day one on everything that happened to this case. And quite frankly, that was odd. A lot of things. There was objects that were never found. For instance, her backpack, her car keys were never found. At some point, there were suspects in New Hampshire. No more by 2019 when we went. All suspects were not suspects anymore, I guess, and the police is now in pitch black, we understand. And that the police was very close to the family. The detective on Louise Chaput's case spoke with family members, spoke with Marie, our medical examiner, and but the police never spoke to us, quite frankly. Yeah. They met us at some point, but they never
spoke on the record.
They never opened. They really were not interested in talking to us into any details of this case, even 18 years after.
Yeah, since we were Canadians, I think they didn't feel the need to, or the they didn't see the interest of talking to us since we were broadcasting in French and since we were working from Quebec. Mm-hmm. So we it was a strange situation when we talked to Chuck West and when we met the we finally got an answer. Yeah, the lead detective in the case. So yeah, it was a really odd situation because Marie Pinault, the medical examiner, the coroner, was really invested in the case, and it changed her life. And it was a friend of the family in my case. And so we spent a lot of time with Marie, and we felt that she became a doctor because she felt powerless when Louise was murdered and they couldn't find any answers to her crime. So yeah, so it's quite a story that spans on almost 20 years, and Boris went around Quebec, went down to New Hampshire and Massachusetts.
A little town called Gorham.
Yeah, Gorham.
Just by Pinkham Notch, the White Mountains Lodge there.
So yeah, it was really strange since we're Canadians looking into an American crime.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the reason I assume one of the reasons you're so interested is because Louise is from Quebec. She left Sherbrooke, Quebec, correct, which Lance and I have actually been to years ago, 2013, looking for Maura Murray. So this this case, you kind of find it eventually if you look into Maura Murray enough.
Yeah, Louise had some, let's say, a lot of friends. She was and she studied in psychiatry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of her friends wrote a movie about the case, the murder of Louise. So it was kind of a starting point for a movie that was released in 2006, 2007 with big actors from Quebec.
It was not very good.
No, it was not a good movie, but it's like a big production.
What's that called?
It's called Sans Elle, Without Her.
Mm-hmm. I got to find the movie in the public library it was nowhere on the internet.
It wasn't really good. One of her friends was one of the most famous columnists in Quebec working for La Presse, called Nathalie Petrovski. It's a journalist that everyone knows in Quebec. She's still alive. Boris got to meet her. So the story was very much in the public eye. People in Sherbrooke still talk about it.
It was a well-known case in Sherbrooke. Sherbrooke, which is a southern city of Quebec, so it's really close by the border. And I think that people of Sherbrooke used to go very often to White Mountains area. And what was strange, I think that in the first days of her when she got missing, I think that police in the United States didn't really catch up why she was hiking alone to start with. Friends of family got many questions about how come this woman just leaves her family and go hiking alone in November, because it was November 15th. I don't know if you mentioned it, but in 2001. So we got to do a little bit of inquiry. We went to Sherbrooke also. Yeah. We asked neighbors, friends of family, how come did Louise left to hike alone to start with? And what came out of that was that she was overwhelmed by work, I think, and that
she needed to breathe a bit. And
she was an original. She was the kind of woman who just goes into adventure all the time. This was another thing. She was fearless when she was living, and she did tons of crazy stuff. And I think her daughters that never got interviewed, they were reluctant to talk to any medias because some medias in Quebec were not very respectful with them when they were young. But they talked to us and they told us how their mother was into adventures and was fearless. And some of them told me it's almost like if it was to happen. I mean,
yeah.
She had to go like that.
She had to push boundaries all the time. And even some friends were asked if they would like to join her just before she left. So she wasn't planning to be alone, but she didn't wait for other people to answer the call of adventure. She just was fearless, like we said, and she wanted to just get out of the city, get out of Sherbrooke for that weekend. And the thing is that in September, with 9/11, the girls, they were supposed to leave. Louise, Marie, Nathalie, all her friends wanted to go hike in the Middle East.
Yeah, they were all supposed to go for a trip, which was canceled because of 9/11.
Since it was so hard to get on a plane. So that was supposed to be the trip originally, but they canceled it because they didn't want to go. They didn't want to fly out to Middle East, and they were all white women, so they weren't too comfortable crossing the ocean to get there. So Louise really wanted to do something. She was hyperactive, let's say. Mm-hmm. So she didn't want to miss out on that. She had a long weekend, so she had to do something. So she went down to the White Mountains.
And this is part of the reason that maybe the murderer was never caught. It was that she wasn't declared missing after many days after, because she was murdered on the 15th, which was
Thursday night.
And then her family didn't wait for any calls. I mean, she was just hiking the mountains for them until the Monday morning, when she didn't show up for work. At which point, the family members said, "Okay, something's up there. What happened?" And then they called the police, and then New Hampshire police was like, "All right, is it a woman lost in the woods? Is it
did she want to?
She had a lover at some point?
Yeah, yeah. Did she want to disappear at first? Because the police in the United States thought that it was strange for a woman to hike alone, to leave without anyone else. But in Quebec, the perception is like, no, women go hiking alone all the time. So it's a cultural difference in the perspective.
Is that something Louise did often?
Yeah.
Hike alone?
Yeah. Yeah.
She
traveled by herself all the time. No, but
all
she
kind
did
of crazy stuff. Her daughters never ran off.
Stories to tell.
Stories all the time about Louise doing motorcycle in thunderstorms, that kind of thing.
She was quite a character, so that's why people loved her so much. But she was an independent woman. She was also a psychiatrist working in the prison system in Quebec. So that was also something that the police looked into.
When they noticed there was a crime, because when they found the body after their research and rescue operation, she was found on the day of the American Thanksgiving. So everything was odd with this. But when the body was found, I think it was a big story in New Hampshire, because you don't get killed just by the lodge in the White Mountains, right? This is a touristic place. This is a place where everyone knows this
AMC, it's a small town.
Pinkham Notch Lodge. It's a small town. It's a touristic place. And she was killed less than a mile, a mile and maybe a little more, but something like that, next to the lodge. So everything's off with this murder. And I think that when her body was found, the U.S. police, the New Hampshire
State police,
exactly, thought that it must be a Canadian involved. It must be a Canadian thing.
Someone followed her, went down there because she worked in the prison system, or maybe it was revenge, maybe it was her husband. So they looked into the tapes when Louise was crossing the border, when she was putting gas in her car, but they couldn't see anyone following her. So
in 2020,
there was a ton of leads, or they looked into a lot of stuff. But they even put because some people in New Hampshire and New England speak French. And they put some police officers who understood French just to spy on...
A Franco-American
to spy.
The husband.
Yeah, when the husband came down to for the search and rescue operation, and when he was talking to the daughter or the friends of Louise, they were, how do you say that, eavesdropping? They were listening.
Sure,
to,
you got it.
Surveilling.
Okay. Yeah, surveilling in the cars, in the operations. They were just there and they understood French because he was a key suspect in the case, and they let him go because he was not a suspect for a long time.
Yeah. All that led to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk us through maybe the day or the day before she decided to go on this trip and some of the details of her hiking trip itself and the crime, sort of like maybe a bit of a timeline so that the listeners can wrap their head around those, I think, maybe, you know, 3 days, 4 days?
She basically left town, her hometown, Sherbrooke, on Thursday, November the 15th. To go hiking to the White Mountains because she was, as per her neighbors, sick of her work. She was carrying the pain of her patients, mm-hmm. and at this point she needed some air.
And she asked her neighbors, do you want to come with me? Would you like to go hiking? And people were just like, well, what? It's last minute. So no, we can't. We have the kids or we have to work on Friday. So she left... On the Thursday,
she drove her oldest daughter to college, which was unusual, and she hugged her very tight. Mm-hmm. Her daughter told us so, and then she left. She left with her backpack, sleeping bag, and stuff in her old car. Was it a Ford? I don't remember the model. A green
Ford Focus.
A gray Ford Focus. And then she drove down to New Hampshire, passing by Colebrook, mm-hmm. Entry point in the United States. She entered this place called AMC Pinkham Notch, where she was supposed to have a room.
Mm-hmm.
But since she got there, say, it's not far from Sherbrooke, it's maybe 3-4 hours drive. So she got there too early, and then
her room wasn't ready. I think.
Yeah, and supper wasn't ready. Yeah. She took some information there. She was like, "Where can I do a quick hike around?"
So she talked to the clerk at the desk,
mm-hmm.
the clerk at Pinkham Notch. And he told her, "You can do an hour."
He replied, "You can go to this hike called
Lost Pond Trail,
which I did last year. I kind of remade this journey last fall."
So she parked her car.
This was found later on, but her car was not on the main parking of the lodge. It was in some overflow parking. Which is also the reason why it wasn't found like the first day on. Anyways, she then did presumably this little hike because at the very end point of this hike, which is very very short, she got murdered mm-hmm. there. Stabbed multiple times that we know of because the police opened up a little bit about the stabbing, but they told me the family members many more details afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So we knew that she tried to fight.
There was
signs of her resisting. And she was found off the trail, not too far from the trail. Strange, and underneath a pile of leaves, since it was during November, and she was burned also.
She was burned. I think that's a detail that I don't forget about it, but it's a detail that kind of, you know, it's not very high on the detail list for me when I'm reading about this case.
Mm-hmm.
It was not out. I think we pretty much broke that story. I think mm-hmm. there was...
Because at some point, the police said she was burned, but they backed up on some details. Yeah,
But they offered, once again, a lot of details to family members that they wouldn't disclose otherwise to medias. up to this point. But family members, and we on multiple accounts, we had multiple sources, because it was Marie, her best friend, her husband, who was a suspect at some point, but he had such a strong alibi, he was with his daughters, that he became friend with the lead detective, and
Chuck West,
who shared many details about the murder, so we know.
Yeah, and the family and the detectives were really working together. Marie and her husband Denis, who is really invested in the case, also used to go down to New Hampshire
every single year.
During November to meet with the detectives to try and relaunch the case. So they were there when the body was found. They worked really, really closely with the authorities. But yeah, so coming back to the events, she didn't go back to AMC Pinkham Notch. She didn't go back to the lodge after her hike. And she was hiking with her...
She never checked in.
Yeah, she never checked in. She was standby, and she went hiking with her backpack, which is also a strange detail, because they knew that it was only a short hike. So why would she go with her backpack? One of the theories is that it wasn't her usual backpack that she was walking with. She got the backpack from her sister, so it was maybe she wanted to try it out and walk in the woods just to see with the weight and try it on.
And up to this point, this is a key element of the inquiry. If the police told us last year that if they can have any information on this blue backpack with a Canadian Canadian flag on it, then they can perhaps trace the murderer. So the backpack went missing. We have no idea why she was carrying it at the first place. Was she followed? We have no ideas who could be in the trails. November again. It was November. It was unusual to go.
It wasn't a high touristic season, and there were no valuables in the backpack. So it was a key element of the investigation. The police went around pawn shops, tried to get some sense of who could have taken the backpack and for what reason. But it still is a key element to to the case.
How far into the trail was her body found? And this was the trail was the Lost River Trail, right?
Yeah, the Lost Pond Trail.
Lost Pond Trail.
It's just off the trail, really. The further part of the trail when it loops, pretty much, then you go in the woods. A few meters, I can say. There's parts of this forest that has been cut down at some point for construction work. It's just by the road, by the main road there.
So you can see the trail from where she was found. It's not in the deep woods.
Yeah, exactly. Just as if she was murdered, stabbed in the trail and then dragged there.
Yeah.
Or maybe they fought. We don't know. But there was an effort to cover her body, that's for sure. Because at the very first moment of the search and rescue operation, which took place many days after, because she was not declared missing up until Monday, and then she was found the next Thursday, I think.
And one of the guys from the Fish and Game Department...
We interviewed Rick Estes.
Rick Estes.
The chief, the leader of this team that found her.
Told us...
We interviewed him.
Yeah, Boris met him, and it was quite an interview, and he told Boris, like, all that we know is that she put up one hell of a fight, and we were like, okay, so there was really something that happened. There are a lot of theories that someone was walking by and told her something, or she was someone who would get into fights with people. If someone told her something she didn't like, she would talk back to him. So there might have been something happening with someone else in the trails, but was it another hiker? Was it someone from town? Was it just some guy or girl who was there? We just simply don't know.
Yeah. Was there any thought to her having been approached in the parking lot and not on the trail?
We heard that theory.
Yeah.
Could that be a hitchhiker, for instance? who brought her there. We don't know at this point, mm-hmm. and the police have very few clue. Mm-hmm. There have been suspects in the past, but no more. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know at this point, to be honest.
And there was, like, the police at one point, the State Department and the investigators wanted to move the case forward, and they told the press at some point that they had an important suspect, and they called Marie Pinault, the coroner and our contact here in Quebec, and they told us, like, yeah, it's going forward, and there's probably some interesting news, and there was none, which is once again really strange.
It was exactly when they launched a cold case unit at the New Hampshire State Police. The Louise Chaput's case was on top of the list, and they made a press release. We have a suspect. They mm-hmm. made big thing. It turns out to be nothing, which is, and maybe this is the very reason why they're so shy into talking to media now. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were that close of, putting the handcuffs to someone, and then it turns out they don't have the necessary proof. That might just be it.
Or it might have been that it was a political move to say that some of the important cases were moving forward. I guess we'll never know.
Because when we met them 19 years after the fact in November last year, 18 years after the fact, we talked to the lead detective. He met us off the record, and he was pretty convincing in telling us that he was that close of finding someone. He was just a phone call away from the file getting, you know, prioritized or something, that they just need more information. He basically told us someone just might have an information out there in New Hampshire, in the White Mountains area, that is, and for some reason someone might want to go see the police now mm-hmm. in 2020.
So they still think that it could be solved. Mm-hmm. and they really wanted us to try to tell the story or the things that we knew in English, try to do an English version of the podcast. We've had some phone calls about the case mm-hmm. in English. We've had some producers asking if they could work on what we got on the field and through the interviews to do an English production. We're always open to that. But it was the meeting with the police and their attorneys was really strange. And the family was there also. We were there with Marie and Denis. So Marie, the coroner, and her husband, and Louise's daughter. We even drove back to Montreal and Ottawa with the girls. So we got maybe 6 or 7 hours in the car with the girls in a snowstorm in November, talking about the case. But the Chuck West was skeptical with us.
I think the podcast format, he was not pleased.
And he might be listening right now, because I know he knows you guys, and he told us that, and not pointing at you specifically, but he was afraid that
we can do some harm.
The investigation, and that we were armchair detectives and just guys spending all their life on Reddit trying to solve some crimes. And we were like, no, Chuck, I don't want to brag, but we won awards with the first season of Saint-Eyes, and we're reporters. We worked for the CBC and Radio-Canada. Like, we have an ethical approach to journalism, but mm-hmm. he just wasn't in. Maybe
wasn't buying yet at all.
Yeah. So he wasn't too sure how to deal with us, and we're Canadian, so it's not the same approach. Like I told earlier, maybe he didn't feel the same need to talk to us, since he thought that we were speaking primarily to a French audience, which is true.
On top of that, all the Canadian leads to this case pretty much vanished.
Yeah.
By now, I think the main theory is that it's an American or a local murderer.
They're focusing on the possibilities in the United States. So But when we arrived there, there was a moment. Maybe we can roll some tape for you guys eventually. Maybe we can send you some, just a file of this strange meeting that we had. A strange encounter. Boris was always looking for some leads and for some people to talk to in New Hampshire. And we were meeting with the investigation team and the family. Was it in Berlin?
Yeah.
Berlin, New Hampshire.
No, it was in Gorham.
No, in Gorham, yeah,
the
exactly.
Police station of Gorham.
Sorry, we know the area, but it's been a few months.
It's last year.
We were waiting for the family to arrive to get this meeting with the attorney, the district attorney, with Chuck West, with one other investigator, both daughters of Louise, Marie, and Denis. So we got there 15 minutes earlier, and Chuck West came outside and told us, yeah, we'll wait for the family. We'll take 15 minutes with the family, and then we'll get you guys into the room with us to talk about the case off the record. And Boris was trying to talk to a guy who
called the police on some pawn shop owner, saying that he saw the backpack at some point early 2000s.
There's this amazing journalist called
Barbara Tetreault
who worked for the
Berlin Sun. She covered the case locally for the past 20 years, basically. And
she interviewed Boris about our series. So there was a paper published in the Berlin Sun. So some guy got in touch with Boris to talk about the case, the situation. Yeah. So Boris looked into it. So this strange old guy
who was a suspect at some point because someone called the police on him having the backpack, turns out that it led to nowhere. But
the guy who called...
We had to call this guy, right?
Yeah, the guy who called the police at first. Yeah. So we met him. We were looking for him when we were in New Hampshire. And I don't know why, but...
I told him, we're going to meet the police at this time. And he was waiting for us in his pickup truck in front of the police station.
80-year-old guy with his dog in his, I think, red pickup truck waiting for us just in front of the police station. So we felt uncomfortable because we were at the police station to talk to Chuck and the family. And this guy who wanted to speak to us, and we were looking for him in the New Hampshire area. He was there, and
he admitted to us that he was by the police at some point. He was perhaps a suspect
in 2001. And when he was interviewed or met by the police, Chuck West, the lead detective, told this guy, I'd like to pick your brain about this case at some point. And the guy was like, yeah, call me because I have a lot of things to say about the case. So this guy is parked. Mm-hmm. We're talking to him, and Chuck West comes out of the police station. And the guy sees Chuck, and he's like, hey, Chuck, remember me? We met 18 years ago.
You never called me back.
You never called me back. I had some things to say about this case.
He was very embarrassed, I think.
Yeah, and then Chuck just went back inside. So this was so strange.
Uncanny.
Because the feeling that, and I'm not saying that it's the truth, but the feeling we had is that people were coming to the police with some information, but the police didn't always call them back. And that's the same feeling we had with the Valérie Leblanc case, our first season of Saint-Thys, is that so much people in Quebec told us that they had some leads or they had some ideas or suspects about the case, but the police never called them back. And we know that police filter information all the time. It was just surprising at this point that so many people and people that we filtered or scanned and just to see if they were, it was not a mental health condition or some crazy people just that wanted the spotlight or wanted to be featured on a podcast. We were surprised at the fact that so many people had some information and they never heard back from the police. And the approach of the police is always, call us. We need some information. You might be the person who can help us solve this case. And those people would never get answers. That's the feeling we had when we met Chuck West in New Hampshire. And I think we got off off the we
wrong
just
foot.
Yeah, off the wrong foot with Chuck, because we were there with our microphones and recording machines, and we were just clueless, and we didn't want to interfere in the talk. So yeah, when we got in the office, we had to wait for an hour mm-hmm. and a half for a meeting that was supposed to. Just a quick chat that was supposed to be 15 minutes between the detective team and the family. We felt kind of anxious because we wouldn't have any feedback for that hour and a half. And when we walked into the room without the microphones just to talk about the case and our approach,
they were closed off.
Yeah, and we were antagonized a bit. So it was like a breaking point for us. We were like, oh my God, we're not here to say that the police did the wrong job or that you didn't do your job. But we felt a bit of, I don't know how to say it, but they weren't really happy to see us there with trying to talk to some locals and just get to know the case a little bit better.
Yeah, I think the term is kind of like stonewalling. Like they're not going to give you any information. But I mean, we found that with Moore's case as well.
And exactly.
The subsequent cases that we've been looking at, that people will find something that they think is significant in the case. They think they found some evidence or they have a lead, and they answer law enforcement's call when they say, you know, we need the help of the public. I think what people, and we talk about this a lot, I think a lot of people expect to hear back on that, and that's just not in the playbook of law enforcement whatsoever. And at that point, with everything that happened with Moore's case, I'm sure Chuck West was like, oh God. I mean, you said he didn't mention you said he didn't mention us specifically. I wouldn't be offended if he did, because I mean, we do know that we come with a bit of a stigma, because a lot of people have done a lot of harm to this case continue to do harm to this case.
No, he mentioned you guys. I can confirm, but he didn't talk trash about you guys. That's what I wanted to say.
Well, he better not have.
No, that's understandable. Yeah, with the fellow that they apparently didn't call back, it's probably the kind of thing where they know that guy pretty well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Like, and he, maybe talks to them frequently about stuff. Like, you know, I think we get that too occasionally. Like, you kind of hear from similar, like the same people, you know, about certain cases or even different cases, you know?
Yeah, but it's usually, let's say, one people out of four or five that call us that might have just a piece of the puzzle that we can use. But most of the times, and it's probably the same with you guys, we cannot use this information, or like we never want to interfere with the police's work. And we try to build those relationships, even with the police here in Quebec. We try to have a dialogue, and they would never call us back. They for the case in the first season, they did one interview, and that's it. And we tried to get some other meetings off the record, or just to help with the case at some point, and they would never call us back, which is pretty bad, because people called us instead of law enforcement because they felt that they weren't listened to. So it's kind of sad, because people want to help with the case, and when they call the police and never hear back, it's just as simple as police calling back and saying, we got your information, thanks a lot, we'll look into it, and maybe give a follow-up a year after that, just something not to have some consequences on the case when talking to the population. But I just think that they need to build trust with the people to whom they wanna talk or have information, because they always say, and I know that people might find this, might, I don't know, have less trust in the police or the law enforcement, because they always say, we need some information, and they give some and they never hear back. So we don't want to be the like the bounty hunters of Quebec, looking into some cases and trying to catch the guy who murdered Louise or Valérie. We just want to document the story and refresh the memories of some people, because some elements in the first season really helped us move forward with the case of Valérie. I'm jumping back into the season one with Valérie, but she was 17 and her boyfriend, she was 18 and her boyfriend was 16 or 17, and she left her just an hour or maybe half an hour before she was murdered. So the guy who was a minor at that time in Quebec wasn't met by the media. His name wasn't published or anything. And we got on his track and we were the first media who we would talk. So it was a key element, and we got his testimony, and it we kind of broke through some new elements, and we're still looking into the first season because mm-hmm. of the podcast. We were able to get some information, publish some information, broadcast them, and some people would call back. So we just wanted to establish a dialogue with the police here in Gatineau, but they would never talk to us. I don't know why. Maybe it's because they feel like we're criticizing or trying to do their job. We think we might be able to do a better job than them, but it's always clear that it's not the objective with Saint-Thèse, because we're doing the synthesis of the cases that are unsolved, and we just want to bring them back in the public, just to get the things going forward. And even with season two, so many Canadians and people from Quebec go hiking in the White Mountains, since it's not too far from Sherbrooke, from Montreal, from Ottawa and Gatineau. So people go there all the time. We got so many messages of French-speaking people who go in the White Mountains, no Pingham Notch. So I think it was useful for some information. So I don't think that us working in French is a motive to not speak to us, because so many people listen to the things that we publish, we broadcast.
Yeah. If someone has seen this blue backpack with a Canadian flag, that is the item that mm-hmm. That is still being looked for. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's correct. And the police is still looking, yeah.
I bet anyone who's got that blue backpack will get a call back from the police.
I hope so. And they're the car keys also.
The car keys of the Ford Focus.
But, they're missing.
I have a quick question that I don't want to forget. I know she was stabbed multiple times. Is there any indication that she was stabbed with something other than a knife? Is there any information on what she could have been stabbed with?
Unfortunately, we don't know
the nature of the wounds, but what we could read through the lines was possibly, we think, a knife, but we cannot.
It was never found, as far as we know.
I was just thinking, like, anyone could determine the type of knife, whether it was something that was, I guess, related to hikers or hunters, or if it was, you know, more of a consumer type knife, like a pocket knife.
Yeah.
Or something.
Well, the thing is that there are two things.
The body was found quite after, like a week after the fact. So it was damaged also by, like I said, some the murderer put some accelerant or some gas. We don't know the nature
on the body.
Yeah.
But it was November, so she had a coat on, and it was also something sharp enough to get through everything and to everything she wore. And the thing is that Pierre, Louise's husband, told us that he walked through the woods with Chuck looking for clues, and that
he took the test, how do you say the lie
yeah, the test, polygraph.
Yeah, exactly. He took the polygraph against the advice of his lawyers because he really wanted to.
He was convinced.
Prove,
he wanted to prove Chuck that he really wasn't the murderer, and he found some little alcohol bottles.
Yeah.
In the field, so in the woods, so
just
he was like, "Did you scan everything? Did you went through all the possibilities? Because we're still looking for keys. We're looking, there's an arm to the crime." And he found some clue just walking through the woods. So that was kind of, it was odd. And
that's a bit odd. I'm still kind of hung up on the knife. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's okay.
So you said that she was wearing several layers of clothes. So she was stabbed through a jacket and layers of clothes. So right there, you have a knife that is probably more than 8 inches or so, 8 or 9 inches.
One of the thing that we took note, or the most important thing that Chuck West, the lead detective, told us, is that you have to get the message out to the hiking community. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways to interpret that that idea. Is that he wants people to be safe, or that people in the hiking community might have some information, mm-hmm. might know something. So is it like a knife that you would use on a camping trip, or is it like a kitchen knife? And we read through the case that Chuck solved in the book Judgment Ridge, where the two college professors were killed. I think that was in the
Vermont, New Hampshire area. I don't remember the place, but
Dartmouth, is that it?
Yeah, they found the murderers thanks to the little the little knife holder, right?
Yeah.
Or the
I don't know if you guys remember that case.
A small detail can lead to solve a case.
Chuck West was the guy who solved the case, and the main clue. He's like a national hero. He's such a.
We found out that he's a famous policeman, actually.
And looking through
officially retired, but now working for the cold case unit.
Yeah, so that was in 2001, just a few months before Louise got murdered, and there was a murder with some knives, and the knives were kind of the key object and the key point to getting this murder solved. And Chuck looked through the people who sold the knives online. So yeah, the knife is an important key element to this to the Louise Chaput's case.